Good afternoon. We're going to call this meeting of the House Resources Committee to order at 1:07 p.m. Today is Monday, February 20th. Members present here, we previously had everyone for the House Finance Subcommittee, so hopefully members will be back momentarily. With us at this time to have a quorum are Representative Justin Paris, Representative Dave Tallarico, Representative Harriet Drummond, Representative Andy Josephson, and myself, Representative Garen Tarr. Assisting us today is our recording secretary, Ms. Debbie Tillinghast, and our LIO moderator, Kelsey Goodall. Thank you both for being here to help out with us today. Before we start the presentation, if we could please ask members to silence their cell phones. Today's presentation will be done telephonically, so my staff will be helping Mr. Ruggiero with advancing his slides. And to keep us on track, we'll do what we've been doing in the past, where we'll answer questions at the end of the slide before we advance to the next slide. Mr. Ruggiero has 4 years of experience in the energy industry, both as an industry member and as an analyst. He's going to be in town next week, and so he is hired by the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, and members will have an in-person opportunity to meet with him next week and ask any questions. And so if Mr. Ruggiero is on the phone.
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you for joining us. Members should have the Developing Petroleum Fiscal Policy PowerPoint was emailed out to everyone. It should be available on BASIS for those of us, those folks that are following us online. And so, Mr. Ruggiero, if you would please put yourself on the record and then begin. And again, what we'll do is try to take questions at the end of each slide before we advance to the next one. So that hopefully on the phone that'll make it easier to and not interruptions, and we'll go from there. Please let the record reflect that Representative Birch has joined us at 1:09 p.m. Okay, please go ahead, Mr. Ruggiero.
Chairman Tarr, thank you. My name is Rich Ruggiero, and I presently am the managing partner for Castle Gap Advisors, LLC, and we're involved with consulting and financial advice in the energy industry. If we go to the second slide, which has my bio on it, what I just wanted to let the committee know is my comments are going to come from a couple decades of actually being a negotiator for big oil and negotiating with governments such as yourself over fiscal terms. I then had over a decade working with the consultancy Gap Decline, and in which I then negotiated on behalf of governments with oil companies on the other side as to what fiscal policy should be, contracts, etc. Those of you that have been around for a while will know that I spent parts of 2007 through 2010 in Alaska as a member of the Gap Decline organization, giving advice on ACES, AGEA, gas oil decoupling, as well as a number of other matters. Any questions?
Please continue.
Okay, if we can pop to slide number 3, the agenda that I'm just going to go through today is what I'm trying to do is set the scene for what I call the background and the overview of what are all the things you need to think about when putting together a petroleum fiscal policy. So I'm going to go through some background perspectives. I'll follow that up with how Alaska compares, and I want to talk about those type of comparisons. A few observations, and then talk a little bit about the need for data transparency as a way to allow a government to actually put together an effective and responsive fiscal policy. So if we can now advance to slide number 5, which is the foreword, you will see in the document that instead of recreating a number of slides, I pulled a number of graphics that represent the oil industry worldwide. And I've done that because they are representative of what's even transpiring today And if we had spent the time and money to update them, they would be telling us no different story than they're going to tell us today looking at the slides as we look at them. And one of the really things that I want to emphasize at this point in time is you will have a number of people, and at times even including myself, that will tell you an awful lot about what has happened. But I think the really issue that you all need to really think about and contemplate is what is going to happen and how the state of Alaska is going to be prepared for what may be coming up in the future. Lastly, I think working from a common understanding of your position as a government, the oil company's position, and there's a third one that I can bring to the table that I didn't bring up in my bio, is I did spend the last 6 years as an executive with Baker Hughes. And so I can also help give you a piece of the energy industry that's sometimes not represented in these discussions, which is the service side, and how they're impacted by the various policies that come across.
Madam Chairman?
Just one moment. Are you finished with this slide, Mr. Ruggiero? Okay, Representative Birch has a question.
Yeah, I just wanted to thank you for the presentation. I just had an opportunity to thumb through it. Is it fair to say your first slide introduced your experience with ACES? Is it fair to say that you were heavily involved with the administration and the development of ACES as it was originally conceived?
Through the chair. For the ACES special session, the answer is yes. We were asked to come up for 3 days, and I came up with a change of shirt and ended up being there 31 days until the thing was finished.
Okay.
Do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, by way of follow-up, would you say the ACES, the initial cut at ACES, I think it basically, you know, it raised $300 million, and then when the legislature completed working on it, it raised twice that. Were you involved in that progressive advancement where it basically doubled the last who's clear and equitable share?
Representative Birch, through the chair, what I can say is we were there giving advice, and in time what we had to work with was what the various committees in both the House and the Senate were coming up with as their suggested committee substitutes, and we were then giving advice as to how those committee substitutes relative to the initial bill by the governor on how all that would play out. So we did the analysis and gave the administration advice.
Okay, and then last,
Representative Birch, did you want to follow up
through the chair? Yeah, would you say today that if you had it to do over again, would you should we be looking at SB 21 or would the ACES be a better path forward?
Representative Birch, through the chair, I think can I save that question and I will come back to it once I have gone through my presentation. Because I think you need to see some of what I'm going to show before I give an answer to that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Ruggiero. Please.
Thanks.
Just want to remind members to please ask your questions through the chair. I know people get excited, but we just need to be respectful and have a little process here. Mr. Ruggiero, please continue.
Okay. If we can now move to slide 7. This is a slide that I've used for years, and I'm always amazed at people's reaction. But to me, the only constant I've seen in my 40 years in the oil patch is change. And I know all sorts of people talk about stability, you know, the need for stability in order to do things. But in the 40 years I've been around, I've never seen stability. All I've seen is the need for companies and any player in the oil patch be very nimble, to be very open-minded, and to keep an eye out for change that may be coming. And regardless of whether it's price or policy or people, technology, and even fiscal systems, there's never been a period where things just have kind of stayed the same. We're always in a constant state of flux. So when people tell you, you know, we need something very stable because I need to develop something over time that's very stable, they're really not talking about the energy industry that we see in the world today. slide 8.
Representative Rauscher had a question.
Yes, through the chair to Mr. Rosario. I think with slide 3, it said that this is about developing a petroleum fiscal policy. It's my opinion, we already have a policy in place, and right now more oil is going down the pipeline. So what changing or reconfiguring or adding to, or I guess I'm trying to understand where we're headed here.
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, what my intent is, and my discussion has been, is to have all of us start off on a level playing field, because I know when I went through this in 07 in Alaska, and I've gone through this in other regimes that I've advised, is everyone thinks that things are going to be stable and that you can predict the future is going to turn out a certain way. And so I think if there's a takeaway that I'd like you to have from this slide and the one that follows, is that there never is a period of true stability, and your policy has to address the fact that there is going to be change. And I will get into a few of my observations on where I think Alaska's policy is not ready to address the fact that we're in a constantly changing environment.
Follow-up, Representative Rauscher.
I know that I'm always worried about whether or not we're changing too often, whether we're getting our partners exhausted from change. But I'm just hoping that we all. I just get worried about that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Rauscher. And I guess now is a good time to just remind folks that of the changes that have been made, half of the changes were requested by industry and half were initiated by the state. So in terms of who initiated the changes to the system, industry themselves have requested several of those. Please continue, Ms. Ruggiero.
Thank you. If we're on slide 8, I think this is just a continuation of the comment I made on slide 7. Is that I'm just trying to build the common foundation so that way when you do put your ultimate changes, which you're working on, to your policy, that you take into account is environmental factors. And although you may think these are very trying times because of the price of oil, the reduction in revenues for the say credits, etc., the point is there have been trying times all through my career in the oil patch. But the one thing I do know is the oil patch basically has a way of finding its way positively through whatever challenges are thrown at it. And again, my last comment is people want to talk about building a stable fiscal policy, but how do you do that in an industry in a world that's anything but stable? Ready for the next slide?
Seeing no questions, next slide, please.
Okay, slide number 9. Just to give you an idea of the scope of change that we can find ourselves in 2005, I was involved with studies, and the United States was looking to import 8 BCF a day of LNG. And they're going to be importing that somewhere between 2012 and 2015. That much gas was needing to come to the U.S. because we were gas short. And there were over 40 LNG regasification plants that were either built or in the permitting stage to be built and competing to bring that 8 BCF a day into the country. If we fast forward just to 2015, we're now in a position where we're looking to liquefy U.S. produced gas and export 8 BCF a day. And there are now 40-plus facilities looking to liquefy what is now a very large cache of U.S. natural gas reserves in order to put them into the market and get value for them. So we've actually done a flip from 8 BCF a day importing to 8 BCF a day exporting. That's a 16 BCF a day flip. And the implications of that, as I've got down, actually impacted the size, the timing, and the cost projects on 5 different continents. Ready for next slide?
OK. Okay, next slide, please.
This next slide is, if there is a second constant, and I don't mean to put this forward in a demeaning way, I'm putting it forward in just a matter-of-fact way that it's something you're going to do. And if there's a second constant in the oil patch, is whenever there's a talk of increasing government take, whether it be from 5% to 6% or 50% to 60%, it really doesn't matter, you're always going to get three messages from the operators that if you should change your tax system, you will become unstable relative to everybody else, you will be less competitive to everybody else, and you're jeopardizing possibly jobs in the oil patch in your locale. They are for-profit entities. Their shareholders expect them to get the maximum value they can wherever they're at. This is just a natural reaction. And I can tell you that a letter I wrote on behalf of the oil patch in the North Sea in the 1990s bears striking resemblance to a letter Aoka wrote in 2007 when we were going through the ACES. And that's just because that's the nature that's going to happen. So I think part of what you have to do is decipher from that message what really is very critical and what really is going to kill an industry or really negatively hurt the state, as opposed to that's just their natural inclination that they have to come out and say that whatever you do that takes money out of their pocket is a bad thing. Next slide.
We have a question from Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, this page I spent a little time on. In fact, it made me, I just couldn't quite make sense of it. I also have a business, and I guess I thought about it, and I thought, I would probably have some similar concerns as a business for maximizing my profitability and probably hoping that government earned a little too little. I'd just soon keep all my profits in my pocket, and so I don't think that's unusual or unexpected to think that a oil company would be any different or any other type of mining or so on, any business. So I guess I was surprised to see that as if being a for-profit entity was a concern. But I wanted to ask, I tried to cut out some words and make this read a little more like I could understand it. On the first line, it says, operators routinely deploy the top three detractor themes. So I changed that so I could make sense of it to operators routinely express these top three business concerns, stability, competition, and jobs. And I again began to think about it, and I thought, my business concerns probably are not much different from 10 years ago or even 100 years ago. If you don't have enough money coming in and you have more money going out, you're probably going to go out of business. So business concerns are stable and similar. My question is if these three concerns you feel are a theme that's deployed more than a business concern, what do you think that an oil company's reaction to a suggestion of an increased government take should be?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, if there's one thing that I was wanting to get across here is just that a recognition that the oil companies, as a ongoing enterprise, just like your business, they are in business to make a profit. They're not charities. So it was just a statement of fact that you're going to hear an awful lot of discussion from the oil companies. I think if there was a next step, your question may be, and a number of people may be thinking, okay, then what do you expect the oil companies to do? And I think this is where I will get to later when we talk about later sections on data transparency and the rest, is I can guarantee you that in other venues, because I've sat there on the side of the government in those venues, the oil companies have come in and there's been a much more open dialogue about the type of projects they have, the type of numbers that they have on those projects, what they think costs are, what they think volumes are, when they think they're going to come in, and then talk about the type of fiscal system that would best work, that would meet the government's needs for a share of the income coming in, but would also encourage the projects that they see that are out there. So it's really, what I've really seen in other regimes that I've been in is there is a oil company government partnership instead of an oil company versus the government type relationship.
Follow up, Representative Johnson?
Yes, I guess I'm still puzzled. If partnership means that there's a hand in my business pocket, I guess I might be reluctantly have a partnership, but I don't see it the same in that same sense of feeling uncomfortable that they're a business. They have business concerns, and they express those concerns, and the state deals with it. I mean, just like they would any other tax structure. But, maybe I'm oversimplifying it.
Representative Johnson, to the chair, I don't think you're oversimplifying it. I think the point I'm just trying to make is when we start getting into the very large values that are associated with oil and oil taxation, that to help the state so it's not constantly changing, so that way it can be more on target with the type of overall policy that would help developments in the state, that there needs to be more dialogue from the operators with respect to what's coming and what's possible and just more forthcoming with what they're doing, so that way you can, it's never going to be, you both mutually agree, but at least the state with what it decides to do will be coming from a position of knowledge and understanding and insight, as opposed to one of guessing what's going on based on a few reports here or there.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, well, as I become more knowledgeable in this, I'll understand it a little bit more.
Okay, we have two other questions. Representative Tallarico.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just wondering here on slide 10, I think that's where we're still.
Yeah,
thank you. In the top with the operators routinely deploy the top three detractor themes, maybe I'll get a chance to talk to you sometime about the way that's worded, because I'll just let you know I'm not crazy about that in presentation to me. Take a little offense to that, and I'll let you know why later. That's not a big deal. But you talk about competition here. Other regimes will be more attractive in comparison. And I just wonder about your some of the shale plays that we have now and the technology and what's happened in the Bakken field and everything. Do you think in the last 10 to 15 years that our competition has definitely, right here in North America, has definitely a change for us when we consider the competition?
Representative Tallarico, through the chair, with every technological change, your competition moves, and it moves around the globe. But to your specific question, yes, Alaska in competition, if it is truly in competition with the lower 48, what they're competing against, the game, the field has changed over the last 10 years, and we'll show a little bit of that in upcoming slides.
Follow up?
Madam Chair, thank you. And through the chair, with the statement jobs are at risk due to potential lower activity, I don't know if that's as much of a theme as a reality. When we reduce activity, And I believe, Madam Chair, that we, as we were doing a decline, I believe that we lost jobs from the North Slope. So just as a matter of clarification, would you say that when activity falls, that we always run the risk of losing jobs?
Representative Chair, that that's just a statement of fact. When the activity slows down, the number of jobs that you need are less.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sure. Representative Westlake.
Yes, and thank you. And I want to, through the chair, I want to thank both my colleagues, Representative Johnson and Representative Tallarico, because I think you bring up a good point, sir. And when you couched it that way, and I look at it from the state of Alaska perspective, you look at us at, for the state is, you look at where we're at now. I mean, what's brought us here? Stability. The state of Alaska is unstable now, and it's negatively impacting our public education, our public safety. There are programs we absolutely do not wish to cut, yet we are. So when we look at it from an Alaska business perspective and the multitude of in-kinds that we do on the social side, you look at OCS, you look at all these other different agencies out here, we certainly are being negatively impacted. As for competition, we hear that as well. We hear other states will be more attractive. We can go down this list here. And jobs, we certainly, you look at last month's report on the job losses out there. So when we look at it, and our charge is being looking out for our individual house districts, I think you've laid it out pretty square. So I do commend you for that. Thank you.
Representative Birch has a question.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. I just would like to ask our presenter, given the breadth of experience, 40-some years in the industry, if you will, have you come across the perfect system? I mean, obviously you're involved in the development of ACEs. You're weighing with some weighing in here with apparently some criticism of SB 21, which is our you know current taxing structure. Do you have in your experience? Do you have a suggestion for a perfect taxing structure or a location where that may have been encountered?
Representative Birch, through the chair. If there were such an animal, everybody would have adopted it by now. Every government would have. And I think the answer we get to is it is no, because each regime has different drivers. If it's a regime where oil only represents 5% or less of treasury input, they react one way. If it represents 50% or more, they react another. If you're an offshore regime versus a mainly onshore, if you're more gas versus oil, there are just so many variables that go into it that to say there's one ideal, the answer is no. Now, there are some things that have evolved over time which have helped governments and oil companies achieve what I'm going to call stability in different ways, which we're seeing being deployed more and more by governments around the world. And the best way that I will characterize it for you right now is that they have self-correcting legislation or fiscal policy, i.e. that it changes itself based on changing conditions in the market and in development.
Okay. Thank you, ma'am.
Okay. One more, any more on this one? Okay, please continue. We're going to slide 11.
Slide 11. It always comes up that Alaska, you know, if you keep changing, you're very, very unstable. And this is a plot that I love, which is courtesy of IHS, which covers roughly a 10-year period, to show you just how many different regimes were changing their taxes. And the orange squares represent where the government increased take, and the green squares represent where a government lessened its take and gave more to the operators. And if we looked at 2011 and through 2016, if I filled this out, you would see it even more populated than it is here, as with the quick run-up in prices post-09 and the quick fall, a number of regimes have all come in with a number of different changes to their fiscal policy. So the fact that Alaska is changing is, you know, if you're not unstable relative to other regimes. There are many, many more changing as you are. And if I could just go to slide 12 before I take questions this one time, Chairman.
Sure.
Is There is a survey that's done of CEOs in the oil patch. And it's an annual survey that's done. And in every year that I've seen it reported, the UK has always been number one to number three at worst as the most stable place to invest. And yet you see in the same time frame where the UK, I mean, Alaska had a couple changes, the UK has four changes, and they've had three since this, the end of this chart, which is 2011 through the end of 2016. So in a period of 15 years, they've had seven changes, yet it's considered stable. And if there's any reason I can tell you as to why it's considered stable, is that when prices start to tank, they get a bit more generous for the oil companies so they can survive. But when oil prices go high, they step in and they take a much larger share of what they consider to be windfall profits.
Any questions? Representative Birch.
How do these regimes function when prices in decline? I mean, and I think that's, again, through the chair. You know, the issue here, I mean, I think we'd be all be in tall clover if we had a, you know, $100 plus oil. But when prices dramatically, you know, decline as they have here, it appears that we don't really have, we don't really increase prices at that point. Is that correct? If I'm interpreting this right?
Representative Birch, could you please ask that question again? I'm not sure I understood it correctly.
In a declining price environment, do the governments typically increase their share or their take?
Representative Birch, to the chair, traditionally most governments lessen their take during periods of low price.
Okay.
Not increase.
Follow-up, Representative Birch?
Reasonable enough. So I guess we've got prices in some cases significantly lower than they were just a few years ago, and we've actually seen an uptick under the SB under the current tax regime, if you will. And I guess I'm concerned that if we start trying to squeeze another $200 or $300 million a year out of the industry in a market that's where it's at today, that we're just basically going to drive them out. But I look forward to hearing from you. But I'm just, again, trying to interpret your slide here. Thank you.
Okay. Now the questions will go on to 13.
Oh, hold that thought. Representative Tallarico has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you had mentioned if you had the rest of the years, is there any chance that you might be able to finish this out to 2016 and maybe provide that information to the co-chairs?
Representative Tallarico, that would be quite an extensive effort, and I'm not sure what it would inform, which is why I stated at the beginning on the slide that was entitled Forward that although some of these slides are dated, the message that they're telling is Alaska should not be embarrassed or feel bad that it's changing its fiscal system, because the regimes around the world where most of the money is being spent are changing their fiscal systems as often or even more often than Alaska is.
Follow-up, Representative Tallarico.
Madam Chair, I guess that means no, that won't be. I would even just like to see North America, if possible, but if not, then we'll go with this.
Mr. Ruggiero, and I don't have enough information for you to know why extending it out to calendar year 2016 would be a lot of work, but if you could think about that and whatever information you could provide to us that you didn't feel like was really cumbersome, that would be appreciated, and hopefully that would address the information that Representative Tallarico is looking for.
Madam Chair, we'll get you some input on that as what it might take when we come up next week.
Okay, and we will be sure to let committee members know as soon as we have more information. With that, I think we're on to slide 13.
Yes, I think a question was asked earlier, do we see things changing in the U.S., say, over the last decade? And my answer was yes. Again, this is a little dated slide, which I could come up with more if we updated it. a slide. It's as over the pie charts entitled Upstream Capital Spend of the Largest IOCs. So we basically took the likes of Exxon and Shell, Total, BP, Conoco, et cetera, and said, where were they spending their money? So what were the regimes that in the competition of one location to another, one basin to another, which are the areas that won out? And as you can see, as we move from 1994, where most of it was Asia-Pac with the South China Sea and Latin America with active license rounds in Brazil and Venezuela and Argentina, that consumed almost 70% of the large investment capital. And in this case, I have to say North Africa includes the Middle East. And by the time we get to 2006, you'll see Latin America has all but disappeared from the big companies. You've got a growth of things in Europe, and sort of North Africa, which includes the Middle East, is taking on a lot of the capital. And in fact, if we just marched to 2008 and went to the Iraq license rounds, there was almost $40 billion committed in capital spend in the various license rounds in Iraq. So when we say, where is the competition? And so if I sit today and I say, let me compare to a regime, let's say, Mexico, that may be where some money is being spent now, but that doesn't mean 5 or 10 years from now that's where a majority of money is going to be spent. And Alaska needs to have a policy that is able to adapt to and be ready for the fact that whatever is the hot spot in the new area, that is prepared to compete with that in the right way.
Representative Birch has a question.
Yeah, I just thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just trying to understand your pie chart. I don't see North America in here. I see West Africa, Asia Pacific, Europe, and North. Is North America on your 2006 pie chart? Is that embedded in there, or is it not included?
This is the competition.
Representative Birch, the chair. It was so small as not to be noticeable, and the reason being is most of the super majors, they may have had some corporate acquisitions, like Conoco had Burlington Northern, Exxon had XTO, et cetera. There was no major capital investment program in development of assets in the U.S. Lower 48.
A follow-up, Representative Birch?
We've had testimony here that the oil industry in Alaska expends upwards of $6.5 to $7 billion a year. And so you're saying that spend doesn't register in this chart as far as an upstream capital spend?
Representative Birch, to the chair, that's right. Overall, the industry is spending $500 to $600 billion, and when you look at the amount that's being spent in these areas, it dwarfs even a number that looks like $2 or $3 billion.
Okay, again, thank you for bearing with. So the 2006 pie chart, you're indicating that the total size of the pie is $500 to $600 billion, and the $6 billion that may be spent in Alaska, which would be 1% obviously of $600 billion, that 1% slice doesn't even register on your pie chart here?
Representative Birch, to the chair, that's correct.
Wow. And that's for all of North America, huh? Excuse me, Madam Chair.
Representative Birch, to the chair. If you would go back to the ACES documents in 2007, you will find a report that Gaffney Klein did that talked about where the big three had spent their money over a period, I think, of the 3 years prior to 2007. And what it would show, Representative Birch, is that very little was being spent in the U.S., that the majority of their capital spend was all outside of the U.S.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. We have another question from Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this is this is 20 years old, a little over that. Would that change if it was more current, where we had the Bakken and other, well, that's the big one, obviously, in the showing. Would North America even made a blip on the radar?
Representative Johnson, to the chair. It may start to show, but remember, this is for only the largest of the IOCs, what I call the super majors. it's not inclusive of all oil companies. But I think when it, the message that I hope to be taken away from this, and I understand the concerns, is that I can just go in six-year increments here, and where the capital in the oil business on the upstream side is being spent moves around the globe. It's very fickle. And it moves because of changes in regimes, locations that were once closed to foreign investment that are now open, even technology which takes something that has been found in the past that was not commercial and now makes it commercial. And the discussion about North America and shale is one of those where technology has created a hotspot where a hotspot previously did not exist.
A follow-up from Representative Johnson.
So would it be reasonable to say then that it is a true concern that other regimes can be more attractive and actually cause investment to be elsewhere fairly easily?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, that is what I'm saying, is that you're competing for capital across the globe. It's not particular to lower 48. It's not particular to the North Sea. You are competing across the globe for that investment capital. And so we then have to understand is what is it about those other regimes that would cause both the very large oil companies and the smaller ones to either invest in Alaska or not invest in Alaska.
Okay.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair.
Sure. Okay, we're going to go on to slide 14.
Slide 14. Hi. You know, there's been a lot of discussion about how do oil companies make decisions on what to invest in. And what I can tell you from my time of being on committees where this decision was made, of being a presenter to boards of projects and budgets that I'd like to see funded, and projects that made it what I call above the line and were scheduled for funding versus those that fell below the line, as well as working for governments and dealing with the oil companies, I hate to oversimplify it, but I've used sort of a rock, paper, scissors analogy because each one of those can trump the other and win. But for the most part, rock is the reservoir, and if there's a great reservoir, it can overcome high taxes. If you look at any ranking that you've seen, WoodMac, PFC, et cetera, go down the list, you will find that the large oil companies spend a lot of money in regimes that have a higher government take than Alaska does, and a much higher government take than lower 48 does. But if you go to the annual reports of the large companies, you'll find they're not spending their money where the take is lower, they're spending their money where the take is higher. Why? Because they have better rock or better reservoir, and they have larger reservoirs. So it becomes economies of scale that really drive it. So what we really talk about is, as long as you've got great rock and great prospectivity, that can trump a tax regime that may look to be a bit too high. By the same token, you'll see tax regimes that are highly progressive in nature, and that is profits get very large, they just take a bigger chunk out of it, and that even though profits on a economy scale basis are not that large, they will trump bad rock, so to speak, if the money can be recovered quite quickly. Shale is a good example of that. You recover in the first year and a half to 2 years roughly 70% of everything that reservoir is going to give up. So you know if you got your money back right away, you've got the cash flow, you can move on. So what we're saying is where companies decide to invest in with a project, it depends on a number of variables, but as long as you got good rock, it can overcome taxes and high take. Questions?
Representative Birch has a question.
Well, when I play rock, paper, scissors with my grandchildren, it generally rock beats scissors, if I remember the game right. In this case, again, through the through the chairman. In this case, scissors being taxes, I mean, we hold all the cards. I mean, we hold all the rocks because basically this body and the state of Alaska at one level or another can exert a painfully large tax structure that would actually, you know, might actually drive investment out of the state. So I guess I'm looking at your analogy, and I realize it's well intended, but I think the fact that the taxes are ultimately the determining factor as to whether you're going to attract investment, whether a natural resource reservoir is going to be sufficient. I guess I'm not following along with your example. I realize it was well intended, but not quite with you there. Thanks.
Mr. Ruggiero, do you want to comment on that?
Yes, Representative Birx, to the chair. We just had a discussion.
We lost you, Mr. Ruggiero. Rock, beat the phone.
Scissors.
Got cut.
Let's see. I can hear a little bit, but not enough that we could
Rock
make
scissors.
Out what you're saying. Let's take a brief at ease. Now we've got it. We think it was a fight with the rocks, paper, and scissors over your phone.
I think Rock won.
I think so, right?
Yes.
So we were just... Representative Birch had a comment that the state sort of holds all the cards in regards to the taxes, and then we were just asking you if you wanted to respond to that comment.
Yes, Madam Chairman, Representative Birch, the chair. The point that I'm trying to make here is people will tell you that your taxes are already too high and they're not going to invest because of the rate or the percentage of tax take that the government has. Yet I would tell you, if you line up the large oil companies and line up where they're spending their money, you'll find out that they're spending it disproportionately in countries that have an even higher tax take than Alaska. So yes, part of what you do have to consider is when you take too much and when you hit a certain tipping point. Now, relative to other regimes, Alaska and companies coming to Alaska, they have to deal with the environment, both the temperature, the location, et cetera, that they may not have exactly the same risks in other areas. So it really then becomes what I have in the first bullet point, which is the right risk-reward balance. So even though Alaska may have great rock and great potential, which in other regimes overcomes the high taxes, there are other issues associated with developing projects in Alaska that have to be taken into account.
Thank you.
Okay. We have another question from Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You just mentioned that some other regimes have a higher government take than Alaska and yet are still attracting investment. Could you name a few?
Representative Parrish, to the chair. Angola, Nigeria, Iraq. Depending on which version PSC you have in Indonesia, they've got five different vintages. You can have higher there. And a couple of the stands, I can't remember exactly which ones, but a couple of the stands like Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, all have higher take. But what you do see, and I guess I could use Angola as an example, at one time they had a marginal 90%+ tax rate. And yet they've got people bidding $1 billion plus for licenses and then doing developments. But, and even the companies like BP and Exxon are there and quite active. But what you see is if you look at their reporting and their annual reports about their investments in a place like Angola is that they have pulled out billions of barrels of oil. It has excellent rock. Now, one place that also has always had a higher marginal rate than Alaska is Norway. And the big three that you have in Alaska are highly invested in Norway and continue to invest in Norway, even though it's got a flat 70% net tax.
Thank you.
Okay. And I know there's a slide on Norway coming up, so we'll have more of an opportunity to talk about that. Representative Johnson has a question.
I just want to clarify now, Norway is actually the full owner of, this is a state business socialist country, isn't that right?
Representative Johnson, the chair. Norway, there's a single taxing entity as opposed to Alaska where you have both state, local, and federal. So the comparison would have to be to the overall take of someone operating in Alaska to the overall take in Norway.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Okay, please continue. I think we're going now to slide 15.
Slide 15. In this slide, what I hope you would take away is if they had their druthers, I put pictures about how fields can be developed and really thinking more about oil fields than gas fields. But if they had their druthers, producers like the quick return, which comes from high IPs, high rates, and then over time they basically sell out. That maximizes their rate of return or their return on investment, and this is what helps to compete against other projects in their portfolio. Governments, on the other hand, have different priorities, and usually they're looking at multi-generational value coming in, and they want to see costs minimized. So the higher the production goes, the more you have to spend on facilities to produce it and handle it. If I actually take a slightly lower rate in the beginning and keep it steady for time, that minimizes costs and that thus minimizes deductions and the state participation in it. In reality, what normally turns out, and this is what I want to show is on the right, is you'll get that quick production and then decline, but then you'll have a sale or transfer that asset to usually a mid-sized company, and then they'll work it out and then it transfers to an independent. So you get a combination of what the producers need and what governments need over time and actually how it turns out.
Okay, and I just want to comment, for example, IOC, International Oil Company, their slide number 50, which is acronyms, and so anybody following along, if you hadn't seen that yet, just so that if there's something on there that doesn't look familiar, hopefully it's on slide 50. So please continue. We're going on to slide number 16.
Okay. Slide number 16. There's a thing that, as I showed on the previous slide, that fields actually go through, multiple lives. And what I just wanted to bring up on this one, and I noticed when I was looking through some reports last year, there was a version of this presented by the DNR with the SB21 discussion, that the best operators leave oil behind. This is the UK 40s field, which was the crown jewel of British Petroleum. And as you can see with the red line that I have there labeled expected performance on the blowout, that's where they thought the field was headed when they sold it off to Apache. But then you can see what the production did when Apache took over. And that happened for a number of reasons. One is you get a new set of eyes. There's kind of a joke we have in the industry that when you're dealing with the crown jewel field, and I had this happen when I was in Amoco as well, as a youngster, if you go in to where companies have had their best geologists, their best geophysicists, their best reservoir engineer say there was no more oil to get, and you said there was going to be oil, that was known as a career-limiting move or a CLM. And so, therefore, as it stays with those companies, it becomes much more difficult in order to improve production and operations. And a new company, besides a new set of eyes, brings a fresh outlook. And a lot of times, new companies coming in tend to deploy the latest technology a lot quicker than the larger companies will do. Now, in this case, the project benefited from two things. It is, one, the new set of eyes, but two, I won't dismiss the fact that the price of oil doubled after the sale, and that encouraged even more development and attempt to find new oil by Apache.
Any questions on this one? I will just comment that the bottom slide in the printed version came out a little bit funny and didn't show the two green colors. The one that's available online should show both, but the expected performance line did come out, so hopefully that's helpful in terms of being relevant to the point that you just made.
Yes, Madam Chairman. I think I can summarize by saying BP expected that just after the sale, the fields would make 16,000 barrels a day, and within months, Apache was able to get it up to almost 80,000 barrels a day.
Thank you.
On to slide 17, this is another example of a field, and this is actually in the Permian in Texas. And this is a field, I'm showing a 40-year life here in the chart. It actually goes on about 50 years with the dotted lines. But this was a field that three times was given up for dead by the people who were operating it, yet it continued to have a new life and continued to grow. In actuality, the cumulative production today is now 8.5 times what the maximum cumulative production that the original developer of the field thought they were going to be able to pull out of it. So we've actually seen a lot more. This is just another prime example that by getting others in with different eyes, with different operating philosophy, that there's great upside that can come. So there's an awful lot. If my takeaway is there's a real reason why to get fresh players into your basins, and that's because these fresh players will bring fresh look, and that fresh look will potentially unlock potential that's not being unlocked by the people that have been there for 30 years.
Okay. Slide number 18.
Slide number 18 is, why does this happen? The first is, when the very large companies that originally developed fields, you'll see that I've circled down there on the bottom that they got a big water kick. And once they got the big water kick, it was, oh no, I'm going to water out the reservoir, and this is a bad reservoir, I need to get out of here. And that's what I call the Pygmalion effect in big companies. Once something is deemed not to be worthy of any further investment and it's dying, it becomes self-fulfilling because they started with investment, they started with attention, and it continues to fall and it dies. But then you get another operator that comes in, that, and you can see the various things that happen on this field is you got the second operator that ran it, just had a totally different view of risk, of what was risky and what was not, and what they were willing to try. The third brought in a different business model, and the fourth really brought in the technology. And it was the technology that really then made this field skyrocket. So there's lots of different reasons why, but there's actually a lot of life in old fields. And as I put down there as my bottom comment, is I'm unaware of any major field that has been developed and then abandoned by the same large oil company.
Okay, please continue.
Slide 19 is to talk about the different type of contract that's evolving in the industry. You have what you'll commonly hear too is royalty and tax as a way of going forward. Then you have the production sharing contract. There's this emerging risk service contract. And it's just a different form of developing hydrocarbons on behalf of governments. But the key thing is we do know that the super majors are entering into these type of contracts in places like Iraq and Iran, but that's not the key thing that I want you to take away. The key thing that I would like to be the takeaway here is that we have the large service companies, and Schlumberger, Halliburton, Baker Hughes, are starting to get involved in providing capital, downhole technical expertise, the latest technology, and actually operating fields on behalf of governments. So there's a movement. I could also add to them, probably the biggest is doing this is a company called Petrofac. They got its start in the North Sea just operating fields. It's now turned into a major player on the world scene under these type of risk service contracts.
Mr. Ruggiero, could you please just, because it's not stated here on the key, say what the different colored lines are again?
Chairman Tarr, the blue line on there represents the business that Schlumberger has done. The red is Representative Halliburton, and on the far lower right is Baker Hughes.
Thank you. And I think we have a question from Representative Birch.
Yeah, just to clarify through the chair, when you look at risk service contract, is there an equity position involved here? Is there a capital investment, if you will, by any of those contract entities?
Representative Birch, through the chair, the primary tenet of a risk service contract is no equity. But it does, and every one of them do include some capital being invested by the likes of the service companies in doing the deal. It is just a different form of governments getting the capital spent and a different way of paying that capital back to the operator. And probably a second major tenet of these type of contracts is that it's payback basically through production. If the production doesn't come out as expected, then the people putting up the capital won't get their capital back.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, please continue. And just as a time check, 208, we're not quite halfway, so hopefully we'll be able to make it through.
Okay. Yep, 20 is just a summary of the first page, first part. Just change is continuous, and you have to incorporate it in your thinking. Tax increase is going to come with the comments, but as I said, what would be most helpful instead is from the oil companies a specific insight into their future plans or what's probable with the right system in place. New players are very important because they actually have a very excellent track record of unlocking potential that is left behind by the first movers in basins and fields. And then that just brings up the fact that there is no ideal way out there. And then the challenge for Alaska to determine what its fair share is, that creates positive growth for both the operators and the government, because you can't have one win versus the other. You've got to have both winning.
Okay. Oh, one question here from Representative Tallarico.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just determining Alaska's fair share, we certainly have heard the words fair share quite a bit, and creating growth for the operator and the government. I think you mentioned this before, but I guess just your opinion, there is no perfect spot in the tax regime, is there? What we're looking for is that sweet spot and that perfect spot, and I just not sure that there's a possibility of finding that perfect for anybody. Very difficult.
Representative Tallarico, through the chair, that's exactly right, and I will exemplify what you just said on a slide coming up here in the near future.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Johnson has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm guessing that this second bullet is where what you were referring to on my question in the past on the top three. I'm changing that verbiage from detractor themes to business concerns. So my question was, what do you think the top things the oil companies should be doing when they discuss their business concerns related to a tax increase?
Representative Johnson, the chair. I think what I'm trying to make clear is, yes, they will put out their concerns, and they're legitimate concerns. I'm not saying they're not legitimate. But then they need to follow that up with, here's what I think is possible. Here are the three fields I believe I've discovered. They're roughly this size. Here's where they come in. Here's roughly what it's going to cost to develop. So here's what we need to see with respect to what the state's fiscal system is that will make that go for all of it, go as a positive thing for both the state and them. I think what we get is we hear about a potential this, we hear about a potential that. You run a bunch of runs on a model that says this field would look like this, or a hypothetical field would look like that, and that all becomes very confusing, and I don't know how you make a decision off that. But what I'm used to doing is sitting down with the governments when I was the operator, and yes, it was everywhere outside the U.S., is I would sit down with the government, and we would have multiple discussions about what my plans were going forward, what money I thought I was going to spend, where and when, and what I was going to develop as a result of it.
Follow-up, Representative Johnson.
I'm having a hard time visualizing this, and I don't know if there's a question other than I think if I'm just relating this to myself, but if the government comes to me and says we're going to increase your taxes, and it sends me into a concern about my business, my inclination isn't to sit down and tell the tax man all my possible business plan, because I probably don't want to let them know entirely my possibilities. I understand it's slightly different, but I'm having a hard time kind of joining those two possibilities together.
Mr. Ruggiero, when we get to the data transparency part, could we talk a little bit more in detail about Representative Johnson's comments?
Chairman Tarr, absolutely. I plan on doing that.
Okay, excellent. I think that'll address some of that. Representative Rauscher had a question.
Yes, through the chair. On bullet number three, the players are very important, as they have new players are very important. They have an excellent track record of unlocking significantly more production from the otherwise mature dying areas. So, but earlier, I think way on earlier, you said that the first 2 years, and correct me if I'm wrong, the first 2 years were the most productive from a field, and that so basically, even though they're in there kicking and working hard, what we could expect, the profits wouldn't quite be the same for the state or for them either. Is that correct?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, if I can clarify and clear up any confusion, what I said on a shale well, the reason why the oil companies like it is because the majority of what they will ultimately recover, they recover in the first year and a half to 2 years. If you look at, say, deep water Gulf field, even some of the Alaska fields, in the first 2 years, they may only recover 20% of the ultimate production that they're going to get out. What you recover is a function of both the facilities necessary to produce it and deliver it, as well as it is the best way to produce a reservoir. And some reservoirs, for example, if they have an active water drag, don't want to pull them too hard because you'll ruin and you'll greatly lessen the amount of ultimate oil you'll get out. You want to take it slow and steady. So it all depends on the nature of the field that you're dealing with.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson has another question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, and I don't know entirely what you're advocating for. I mean, I don't know or if you're just presenting information, but from what it sounds like, potentially you're advocating for even different structure for different fields or different types of production.
Representative Justice, the chair, I'm not advocating anything right now. What I'm trying to do is set the scene so that way everyone comes from the same general understanding of the landscape into which you must create your fiscal policy.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. All right, we are headed to slide number 22.
Yep. Part of what I'm putting up here, and you may have it, and I may not have just have seen it, but you really need to have a plan for what you're developing your policy around. And in putting that plan together, I've really put some things up here that in designing that strategic plan, as I said, almost anyone with a computer can tell you what happened in the past. But what you really should be asking as a state is, why did those things happen in the past? For example, on my pie chart, the three pies, why did the money move from Latin America and Southeast Asia to the Middle East and Europe? In fact, just knowing that it did tells you maybe 10% of what you need to know. The other 90% is to know why it happened and why that capital moved there. I think my answer to a previous question that was all is that the reason there's no ideal system, the last point, is countries always have different drivers. And that's what makes a straight regime-to-regime comparison of either overall tax rates or marginal tax rates problematic to say whether or not Alaska should be more or should be less or you're in the right place. And there are things that other locales have, for example, that Alaska may or may not have a lot of, things like domestic market obligations. This is actually a requirement on the oil companies in those countries to make a portion of their production available at a highly discounted price to the local market. You have a lot of local content that goes in that is not included in those comparisons. Building of training centers, schools, hospitals, you know, the infrastructure can all be drivers. Another one that I worked on recently, which it wouldn't make sense if you saw what they were incentivizing, you'd scratch your head and say, why are they doing that? Well, that country has a reference crude blend, and they're actually highly penalized if the API gravity of the crude they put into the tanker doesn't meet the specs of that blend. And as either their heavy or their light crudes get to be in the wrong proportion, they then incentivize the development specifically of light versus heavy or heavy versus light. And then you also have, for example, changes that are done because of refinery or power station needs.
Okay.
Let me give you an example of a refinery. If someone was to trend for you the fiscal policy in Trinidad and Tobago, you would see that you got some really strange, highly contributory to the operator programs to go into their mature oil fields and redevelop them. And the reason being is they have a refinery that has a minimum turndown rate, or the minimum rate it needs to have to operate. And it's actually paying roughly $10 over market to get the crude in to keep the refinery going. They would much rather spend that money incentivizing local production than buying import production. So you can have all sorts of different drivers in putting together your fiscal policy. And I think what I'm going to get into is what's key is, what do you see as your drivers for putting together Alaska's fiscal policy?
Okay. Slide number 23, please.
And this is where, yeah, you have to find the right balance, and there's a lot of things to balance. You think some important issues or crises can seem all-consuming. You're not alone. I've been in a number of different places where things have come up where they tend to zero in on what's happening now. But you have to be careful, especially in a place like Alaska, which is very long-term in nature, is that what you do to correct and help yourself in the near term does not in any way jeopardize what is truly more lucrative, and that's the longer-term business for the government. And as I have did last bullet, there's a number of different things that you need to look at, which is somewhat unique to your environment in Alaska, relative to the other regimes that you're looking to compare yourself against.
Representative Birch has a question.
You know, I kind of raced ahead a little bit, and I see you've got aces up coming up here in the batting order here. One of the questions I had is just my colleague from Palmer and I had discussed earlier the merits of SB 21 and the fact that it has generated new investment. We did go through a lot of public discussion, debate, and so finding that right balance, you know, isn't it reasonable to, you know, kind of let this sleeping dog lie in the way of tax structure and just, you know, see how it rolls? I mean, we had an uptick in production for the first time in years, and I know you're advocating for kind of, you know, re-engaging, and I'm not sure where the administration is in this. We'll find out, I'm sure, soon enough, but what's wrong with providing some stability for a year or so, again, through the chair?
Representative Birx to the chair. I'm not advocating anything at this point in time. I'm just going to reiterate that because SB 111 has been introduced, and I understand in an email I got just before coming on here that Representative Guerra has introduced another bill as well, changing taxes, that if you are going to address that in this year's session, I'm just trying to make sure that I give you a good framework from which to make any changes if you as a legislature so choose to make those changes.
My follow-up, Representative Burke.
For follow-up, have you seen House Bill 111, I guess is a fair question, since you're indicating this has got nothing to do with that.
Representative Burke, to the chair, I have seen HB 111, and I have read it.
Okay, because I...
Follow-up question, Representative Burke?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Because it appears to me that you are advocating for changing up our current tax structure. And my assumption has been, and right or wrong, is that it's been in the context of advocating for the legislation that the co-chairs have advanced here. So, but pardon me if I'm wrong on that.
Again, at this point in time, I'm not advocating anything. I'm just hoping that people will take a look at what it is that you're really trying to do, so that way if you decide to act on 111 or any other bill associated with oil tax, that you do so with eyes open and a common understanding as you move forward.
Okay.
Thank you.
I do just want to take a moment to point out, though, during the Senate Bill 21 debates, we never looked at anything under $60. So almost all of the prices we've seen in the last few years were never considered in the Senate Bill 21 debate, which is one of the reasons it brings us to the conversation we're having today. Representative Rauscher, did you have a question? Or Representative Johnson?
Not at this time. I'll wait.
Okay. Thank you. Please continue. We'll be going to slide number 24.
Slide 24, I just put up that I know there's been a lot of debate on whether ACES was put together correctly or not. I've already been asked that question today. I figured it would come up. But what I wanted to do is to state that there was a lot of debate and dialogue for the first 2.5 weeks of the special session for ACES. But nothing really gelled until we came together and said, look, based on everything we're hearing, here's what the drivers are. Have we got those drivers right? Because there's a different fiscal system you put in place for a different set of drivers. And these are the drivers that both the Senate and the House back then agreed were the right drivers for putting together a fiscal system. And so that's what ACES was designed around. And again, if things have changed going into the future and you have different drivers, then you design around those drivers as you move forward.
Representative Birch has a question.
You know, I wasn't quite as engaged on ACES at the time it was up, other than I remember, again through the chair, Senator French talking about Alaska's clear and equitable share, and I was puzzled why the legislative adoption of ACES was about double the rate of the then Governor Palin's proposal, which, if I remember right, had I think the Palin proposal was a fairly reasoned but progressive increase in the tax rate, and then the once the legislature kind of worked it over, it had a progression that was just what I felt and appeared to be very egregious. In other words, the last dollar made in progression basically defined the tax rate at the first dollar. So there's actually no way of forecasting or anticipating what that tax increase could be. Because, I mean, every one of us, and I'm curious as to whose bright idea that was. Did that come from the administration, or did you lay that on the table, or where did that progression idea on ACES, where did that emanate from?
Representative Burks, through the chair, the administration put forward the progressivity at a 0.2. It was the legislature that not only changed that to a 0.4, but then once the 50% was reached, they added in the 0.1 progressivity above that. Those are both two add-ons by the House and the Senate to that bill.
Okay, follow-up question.
Yeah, I just remember that had the net effect of taking something which was by its name Alaska's clear and equitable share presented by the governor, and basically was doubled up when it went through the legislative sausage-making process. And I guess I'm concerned about that because it just hammered any sort of ability to make investments. And I appreciate your perspective on that it basically wasn't your doing. Because I think that was a horrible mistake, and fortunately the good people in the legislature saw fit to change it. But thank you, sir. Thank you, ma'am.
Representative Birch, through the chair, I understand some of those concerns, and they were talked about back then. But I also know that if you look at the numbers, that once ACES came in, investment did go up, jobs did go up, and the rate of decline on the North Slope was less. During that time period, it did not get to the flat as it is now, but all the improvements that were asked about, to a degree, did occur.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's continue on slide 25, and we're getting a little bit close on time here with just a little over a half hour left. We're asking if we can stay on just a few extra minutes before the next committee comes in, but Mr. Ruggiero, I don't want to ask you to go unnecessarily fast or too fast, but to the extent we can get as far along as possible in today's meeting, that would be great.
I'll move as fast as I can. So slide 25. If I had to look at things, this is now where I'm giving some input from my perspective, is your number one strategic goal for any fiscal design is you have to keep taps running. Once that shuts down, your ability to get it back up and running or to get an alternative up and running is just going to be a lot of time and a lot of money. And one of the things that really sunk in with me is in 2007 in a presentation BP made, which was quite informative, they said with investment in the existing fields of Prudhoe and Kabark, they could produce another 7.5 billion barrels. Now, it was going to take about 70 billion in investment, but there were 7.5 billion barrels of additional that could come out of there. That would keep taps running for an extremely long time. I do have as number two, encourage the new players, because I think those new players are a different set of eyes, a different way of looking at things, a different way of working. You got to continue to develop Cook Inlet gas for your utility and Fairbanks and Anchorage, as well as possibly bring in some industry. And then you have to recognize that you've got some unconventional type fields that need to be accounted for, such as the heavy oil and the shale. And then on durability, as I mentioned before, if there's something that I've seen governments doing recently that I think is something to be copied, it's definitely that you create self-correcting mechanisms within your fiscal policy. Whenever you tie something to a specific price or a specific time or a specific production rate, one thing that you know, this is with 100% surety and in my experience, that when you get into the future and that price or that production level, et cetera, is hit, the economic circumstances at the time nowhere match what you thought they were going to be when you decided what should happen when that trigger was hit. And so therefore, define triggers in terms of general principles that can then be put into mechanisms that correct as the economics of the business evolves.
Okay, next slide, please.
Fair share. Really, 27 and 28 is just getting into, finding the right balance, which we've talked about, and that there is a range where government can take a little more or a little less and be okay, and operators can take a little more or a little less, but you then have to worry about the tipping point. And as sort of the fourth bullet there in 27 says, that when you look forward into an unknown future, that you're setting terms now for the future, which you don't know, but you do so usually looking with hindsight back on what happened in the past. And you just got to make sure that when you look to the future, you're looking to scenarios that could happen as opposed to designing on things that have happened in the past.
Okay, next slide, please.
And 28, I think this goes to Representative Birch when he asked, is there an ideal way of doing this? And in my experience of having done this for multiple governments, it's at best one-part science. It's three-part art, and art in the sense of you've got to be creative looking at what's particular to those basins, that country, the needs of that government as you go forward. So it's and if anything gets out of balance, you'll find out pretty fast. If it gets way too heavy-weighted to the government, the operators will disappear. If it gets to be windfall profits, governments generally step in to take more.
Okay, next slide, please.
Go to 29. This is the what I call theory versus practice. The theory on the left, what you have in blue is what generally goes to the operator. And that is he's got his finding cost, development cost, operating cost that they need to recover. And then there's a cost of capital. And this is where you get into the most debate is what that cost of capital should be. And in theory, everything beyond the operator receiving his money back with a return should be rent that is captured by the various government agencies. But as we said, in practice on the right, sometimes the taxes and government takes get a bit high. And usually the operators believe there should be a higher cost of capital. And where I've seen governments fail is that they try and hold operators down to say 12% or 15% or an 18% return because they believe that's a fair amount that operators should make on projects. Well, the operators, rightly so, will come in and say, on everyone that's successful, I actually have to make up for the hundreds of millions, if not billions, I'm spending on dry holes and trying to develop new fields that are not successful. But a lot of the regimes in which I've worked, we try and work from that theory of what are the costs? How do I keep those as low as possible? Because the recovery of those costs cut into the rent that's available on a project. And then what is a fair return for that operator to make?
Okay, next slide, please.
And what I put as the next one is a wrinkle that I think you need to consider is, as the current president has talked about greatly reducing the corporate income tax at the federal level, is if that is reduced, does 100% of that go to the operator, or does the state pick up a little of that in its take? Because again, the regimes that you're comparing against and all the charts that you see are the total take by local, state, province, federal, et cetera, governments, and Alaska is only dealing with one piece of the overall, call it U.S. take.
There's a question from Representative Birch.
You know, we had a lot, we actually had 2 hours of testimony from a gentleman that was talking about take, again, through the chair. Typically, we do include the owner's royalty share as a component of the take, do we not? I mean, I guess that's a question. I mean, it's not unreasonable to say royalty income or royalty shares out of a lease that you've advertised and solicited investment in production, is that routinely thought of as part of the share, if you will?
Representative Birch to the chair, yes. If you look up in the green sections, it's green online, if you can see it there, royalty is listed as part of the rent that the governments capture.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you.
Okay, please continue. I think we're on slide 31.
The next concept when you're talking about how well do I compete is everyone seems to talk to you about what is the percentage take. You know, Alaska is X percent, and it compares to these countries that have a little bit more and these others that have a whole lot less. But that's not the whole story. I can tell you that in developing fields, it's when that tax is taken is extremely and critically important. As you look at the plot right here, this is a hypothetical field, and it's the exact same cost and production profiles and oil price run through the fiscal regimes of this dozen-plus countries. And what you see is in the blue, that is where there is government take prior to the operator recovering all of this cost. the yellow or orangish is where there is state take before the operator, and I just chose an arbitrary 15% return on his capital. And then green is state take after the operator has recovered their cost and a 15% return on the monies that they invested. So you can see that, for example, Australia, which has one of the biggest green bars in the center, and Ecuador, second from the right, are roughly the same take. But Ecuador would be much more risky because it takes a whole lot of its tax even before the operator has the money back. And if we can turn to the next slide, number 32.
Mm-hmm. Hold that thought.
What I did is I took all of those taxes and I just normalized them to 100%. And in deciding on whether to invest or not, and as an oil company, when I'm looking at the risks that are involved, the more blue there is, the riskier it is for me. The more green it is, the better it is for me. Because the green is after I can go tell my committee and my executives that, you know, that regime is not going to take anything from me until I've got my costs back plus a return on capital. Questions?
Representative Rauscher, I had a question.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, just going back to slide 31, and I guess it also, now that we looked at slide 32, that's the United States collectively, not Alaska, correct?
Representative Rush, through the chair, yes, that was a generic U.S. Put together where you've got royalty, severance taxes, and then corporate income tax.
Follow-up question, Ms. Representative Rauscher?
Yes, thank you, through the chair, because I believe Louisiana is quite a considerable amount lower than our state right now in those areas. So I guess it doesn't really explain where Alaska stands in relation to the graph. Across the graph of what you've exhibited here, and I just wanted to point that out, that I'm not sure where we fall in this graph, because I'm not sure where we fall in the United States. Just making just showing it.
Thank you. And Mr. Ruggiero, if there's more specific information you could give us for that analogy, that could be helpful. But I guess your takeaway from both of these slides is just that, in terms of thinking about the risk reward, the timing of when the government take occurs is influential.
Chairman Tarr, exactly. The point I'm hoping to pull from this, I might have been better if I whited out the United States, is just to understand that all taxes at a given percentage are not created equal, so to speak, and that when the tax occurs in the process of the project has an extreme influence on the economics, and then when they put risks and risk weight things, those that have early taxes are going to show up much lower than those that take their taxes later. That's all that I hope that the committee would take away from this.
Okay.
Thank you.
Please continue. We're on slide 33.
Slide 33. Again, just a summary here. In designing fiscal systems, there are no two alike. We take experiences from the past. We take a look at what their needs are. We look into our toolkit, and we decide what might work best for that regime. And many times, governments have their own idea of what they want to do. And I always joke that my role then is to keep them out of as much trouble as I can if they go forward with what they want. And even though the countries have some differences in what drives them to what they want to put in their fiscal policies, there's also a mix from the operators. For example, if I'm comparing evolution, let's say, of the UK fiscal system of the 80s through today, we'll see all these changes up and down. Back in the 80s and 90s, probably 95% of everything being operated, developed, exploration was by the largest of the large oil companies. If you look at it today, they're fairly non-existent in the UK. So there's been quite a change there. So you can get into different sizes of the operator, different capital structures, I think you can get different players. I mean, there are oil companies that like to explore, find, and sell off. Well, there's others that like to come into mature fields, optimize them, and revitalize them. And again, just the final of one part science, kind of three parts art to get it done.
Okay. Going on to slide 35, please.
We've got sort of the alphabet soup of different fiscal systems that the state of Alaska has put through, and the credits were designed to help Alaska be competitive. And it might be a bit early to tell, but in looking at what's occurred with respect to the activity that's taken place and then the production that has resulted from that activity, that there seems to have been some level of success going forward. And, you know, there's talk about, obviously, the production that's there would be predominantly from existing fields, as there hasn't been that much time for whole new fields to come on. And there's also talk about discoveries that could bring in billions of barrels of new oil. But the key thing to remember under that is these large fields from kind of discovery to first oil are going to be 6 to 10 years. And sort of the stability is not so much stability as predictability of what's going to happen, not only over that period, but say over the first 10 to 15 years of production, is what has to be known to give people the confidence to be able to come in and spend their money in Alaska developing oil and gas.
Question from Representative Birch.
Yeah, I actually have a number of questions as it relates to the credits. I've gone back and looked at some of the testimony and the legislative proclamations and so forth when credits were introduced in, I believe, 2013 or thereabouts, and with the intent and objective of bringing in smaller players, not the majors, but bringing in smaller, creative, nimble players to, you know, go out and go forth and be successful. As you're probably aware at this point, the legislature is funded, but the governor has vetoed, the payment of those credits. So we may be close to $1 billion underwater in liability, which isn't much offset with a $6.5 billion investment. I think the credits are around $200 million a year. But are you advocating for credits? I know in one of your earlier slides you talked about for heavy oil looking at incentives. I assume when you say incentives, you're looking at credits as the mechanism that the regime could offer. But where are you at with credits? Is it a good thing, or how do you view them and kind of your global perspective, if you will?
My overall feeling is you cannot change the geography of where the fields are at. You can't change the environmental issues that have to be dealt with relative to other areas. And the fact that it's more expensive, it has been when, you know, oil was first found, as it still is today. Those are givens that you have to operate with. So if you're going to attract capital from other places, if you're going to attract new players, there has to be some form of incentive to drive those people to come to Alaska, or to not just harvest the fields, but to reinvest in the existing fields for further growth in Alaska. So I do think that there's something that needs to be done to encourage people to come and encourage the investment. But I'm not yet got any recommendations with respect to what form that takes and how that should be done.
Thanks, sir.
Okay, slide number 36, please.
This is slide 36, just to set forth that there are, I almost said as many regimes there are, there seems to be that many different types of ways to use the various tools. Let's just, I only concentrate on royalty for one. Looking around the world, you've got fixed royalties, you've got step royalties, you've got royalties that are variable, that can be tied, as I said, to production or to the actual profitability of the field. There's different types of royalty relief, and there's actually a few regimes that have gone to this concept called first tranche petroleum, where actually the royalty is split between the government and the operator, so they each get a guaranteed piece up in the beginning before you then start divvying it up through the various means that you have for taxing and distributing between the operator and the government. You can go into a lot of different areas, and probably one that I'm already looking at a lot and trying to put my thoughts together is in the lower right, the credit versus deduction. And that is something that I've got to think through a lot more, but that's definitely something to look at for Alaska.
Okay. Going forward now, we're going to move to, this is how does Alaska compare to other regimes, slide 38.
Yep. Again, slide 38, there's any number of different ways that you'll see these plots come out. I've highlighted where Alaska is, and again, are you worse than or better than? Is this full cycle economics? Is this the marginal dollar split? Do they include lease bonus payments? If I have to build highways and hospitals and schools, how is that incorporated in here? Usually these representations like this are made off a marginal take. They assume that everything stays constant and there's an extra dollar that either results from a dollar more revenue or a dollar less of cost, and how does that get split? Slide 39.
There's a question from Representative Johnson before we go to the next slide.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would you just, this is to the presenter, I was wondering if you would just give an explanation of full cycle economics and marginal dollar splits for those of us that are not economists.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Okay,
Representative Johnson through the chair. Full cycle economics would be running the economics over the life of the field from first exploration and discovery all the way through to abandonment. And over the life of the field, looking at what is the split between the operator and any government agencies. Marginal dollars, I said, at any one point in time, if I was just to add a dollar more of revenue or a dollar less of cost, so there's one more dollar to the bottom, to my profit line. How much of that is the operator do I get to keep versus how much does the government take? Does that help?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. So the way I see it, the full cycle economics is just economics. I mean, over the entire life of the field. Right?
Representative Johnson, the chair, correct.
And just for members, Wednesday's presentation from Ms. Glover, I want to say, from Department of Revenue is going to delve into some of the life cycle economics, and we'll get an opportunity to look at some specific Alaska examples.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make sure that I'm, and I could probably repeat back what you said about the marginal dollar split. I just wanted to make sure that What you were saying was also what others would be referring to in the same, maybe not in the same terms, but thank you, okay. Madam Chair.
Representative Birch has a question.
The representative from Palmer brings to mind, in looking at the diagram for Alaska on slide 38, if I'm to extract from that, it looks like the government take for oil is around mid-60s, if you will, and increasing. Is that how I read that, with the arrow going to the left?
Representative Birch through the chair. What the arrow represents is where it moved in the period 1998 through 2007. So what's that showing is in 1998, it would have been at the tail, or call it the beginning where that arrow is, and where it's now placed for Alaska is where it is in 2007. You are correct that what it's representing is 62.5%, which if and under ACES at a PTD of between $0 and $30, so no progressivity yet, the overall government take would have been that 62.5%.
Okay, so if I might, Madam Chair, that's fairly close. We've had some representation that one-third seems to be at least in some circles, a target objective. This looks like it's getting pretty close to that, correct?
I represent Burke's the chair. I, in never heard until the other night when I watched Mr. Brenner testify. I've never heard of the one-third, one-third, one-third concept.
Oh, welcome to Alaska.
That's why I put in that theory slide that talks about, in essence, what an operator should get is their cost back plus a fair return and everything else to the government. And whether that ends up one-third, 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 or something different, I'm just saying that's likely that'll happen to be something different because it all has to do with the location, the cost structure, as well as the size of the developments.
Thank you.
Representative Parrish has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just really quickly, look at this look at this slide. In all of these cases, is the government take, well, 100% minus the government take the, well, the corporate portion? Or are many of the, do many of these have non-sovereign sellers of oil and holders of royalties?
Daniel Johnson's curves generally represent the marginal dollar split. And to get exactly how much the operator takes and with the project overall, there are things that are not included in his analysis that would have to be taken into account. So I can't basically say, except on the marginal dollar, that the operator shares one minus what it shows as the government take.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Mr. Ruggiero, what I'm going to do is have you complete your slide deck, and if we have any remaining time, we have about 12 minutes left, we'll do questions. But members, please, if you have questions, write them down, and we will submit them and get responses and make it available for everyone. We don't want any questions to go unanswered. But Mr. Ruggiero is not available on Wednesday, so if we could, with your indulgence, finish today, that would be very helpful. Okay, please continue. We're on slide number 39.
Okay, slide number 39, that's just going over what we just talked about, the marginal dollar versus the overall project split. If what I just took and did is did a new North Slope field over its entire life, and I get somewhere between 55 and 60% government take in the end when everything's considered, but on a marginal dollar basis, depending on price, splits near to the 70% government take. So you have to ask which one shows up. And then again, when you get into overall project split versus marginal split, both for Alaska and for many other countries in the comparable tables, the reason that there is such a difference is because you got all sorts of things that don't necessarily show up, which are the credits being well understood, uplifts that are given, what are called waterfall priorities. Waterfall is just who gets the revenue first, government operator, et cetera, certain caps placed on allowances or deductions or credits, sliding scales, which change drastically. So I can just go through a whole list, but there's a whole number of things that make looking at that any of those charts that are presented and say, I'm competitive or I'm not competitive versus other regimes because we don't know everything that goes into it. And on the slide 40 would be my example of just what I've seen on a number of these comparisons. There's a lot of talk now about Alaska versus Texas. So what's the operator take? And the first question I have to ask somebody is what type of Texas lease is the activity? Now, most of those that advocate that Texas is so much better and Alaska needs to reduce is they'll take a legacy lease with a 12.5% royalty on it. Those are becoming very rare to be found. Now, on state lands, and in Texas, the educational system has a number of lands where they get the royalty. It's a 20% royalty. So you can see almost a 50% plus increase from the legacy leases. And I can tell you from some investments I've been associated with that private leases are ranging upwards of 30%. And right now, in the Permian where it's hot, you can't get anything for under 25% royalty. You then have severance and ad valorem taxes that range from 4 to 10%. And I have to tell you, over the last 5 years, acreage in the Permian has changed hands at anywhere from $2,500 an acre to over $30,000 an acre. So what does that mean? If I take these horizontal shale wells that were talked about earlier, typical in the Eagle Ford, which is one of the very hot basins in Texas, is the EUR, which is the economically ultimate recovery, so that's the amount of oil. You generally get between 300,000 and 500,000 barrels out of one of those wells on a 160-acre spacing. So if I then look at the acreage purchased, did I purchase at the low end or the high end, that can be anywhere from $5 to $15 a barrel. The well, again, depending on the length of the lateral, the type of fracture stimulation you do, those wells range from $4 to $7 million to drill, or roughly $8 to $18 a barrel based on the recovery. And then you get operating expenses of about $8 to $10. So you get an estimated operator cost, including the acreage purchase and the drilling and all, of somewhere between $20 to $40 a barrel. If I turn around and use a flat $60 pricing, then in Texas, the ultimate split of the profit that's generated is 30% to the operator and 70% to both the combination of the various government agencies and the royalty holder. And then if there's annual fee payments, which some of these leases have, then the operator share goes down as there are more costs that need to be covered.
Okay, next slide, please.
41 is about Norway. I'm just not going to go over that in any detail, but I just put this in here so that way you could see that a lot of the features that you have in Alaska are features that they have. They have a few slight twists to them and a different way of doing it, but they are a 78% net taxing area. They have a zero royalty, so everything that they tax is after recovery of costs.
Okay.
And I'll leave you to read that.
Going on to observation on current tax structure, this is slide 43.
43. Just my observation from the other ones that I've worked on, that the current system with GVRs and this tied to this price, that tied to that price, as well as the multiple geographic separations, that you've actually have something with a lot of moving parts, which makes it hard to administer and even harder to audit. The geographical separation, my Simons is Cook Inlet, Middle Earth, North Slope. It allows us credits. We got all sorts of looks at minimum tax. You lack the data transparency that you need to make informed decisions as a legislature. And this is a theme that I have talked about a number of times, that the industry needs to partner more closely with the state as they do in other places. I've seen the players that are in Alaska, and I've sat across the table from them in many other countries. And there's a lot more discussion and a lot more transparency than what I've observed in Alaska. And then, as I've mentioned, too many things that are tied to fixed events, and we need to, my suggestion would be that you look more at some self-correcting mechanisms so you really don't have to come back very often and change things.
Okay, so now we're in data transparency on slide number 45 with 5 minutes left.
I'm not sure how many of you aware, but there has been an extractive industries transparency initiative that's called the EITI. It was pushed originally by World Bank and IMF, UN. It's now got a head of steam up, and it's got a number of countries that are participating. But basically, if I wrap it up very simply, is all payments from companies to governments in extractive industries, that's oil and gas, mining, etc., will be made public. If you quickly go to slide 46, it'll show you all the countries that have signed on and that are moving forward with it as it's intended. And if the colors are coming through, those that are sort of the dark bluish green are countries where there's active disclosure of information. Slide 47. Basically, I can give you the data links, but in Norway, you can go on and you can find out everything that's been paid to the country of Norway, which is a very active place for both BP, Conoco, and Exxon. And in the UK, they have a requirement that any company that's listed on the London Stock Exchange has to make available for the public the tax payments. And in the latest report that was put out by the UK government, it covers the calendar year 2015, BP has published what they paid in taxes to the state of Alaska, as well as to other states in the U.S., but I just extracted the portion for the state of Alaska. And eventually, if you go through the U.S. and the SEC, they're requiring reporting to start in calendar year 2018 for fiscal years ending in 2017. So lastly, operating, the heading on slide 48, you know, operating data is not much different than tax data. I understand the concern that, you know, taxpayer information is confidential, but I can tell you in many countries around the world, you can go online and you can see all the data and details. You can go find out exactly when they got the lease, how much they paid for, what wells they drilled, when they drilled them. And if there isn't anything that's really highly confidential, you can get and take a look at the logs, the maps, et cetera. In granting the licenses, governments have always ensured that, you know, they're the ones granting the rights to their hydrocarbons and their minerals, so they actually have the right to all data, all information, and in some countries, even to the interpretive work that's done on that data and information. And as I said, they publish it if it's not fits a general narrow window of confidential. Not only do they publish historical data, but a lot of these regimes publish forward forecasts. And these are actually pretty elaborate with new fields coming on, when they would come on, how much production they would have, what they would cost, as well as any major refurbishment on existing fields. So you can actually get a sense of how much capital is going to come, how much work there's going to be, and thus what role the government is going to play. And as my last point there, that just aids the government ensuring that they have a fiscal system that's geared properly to ensuring investment in their hydrocarbons that will be competitive in the world market as they move forward.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Ruggiero. We have a question from Representative Birch and then Representative Johnson. I hope we'll have time for that.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just as a data point, we had a great presentation earlier from the Department of Natural Resources, and they are actually cataloging and taking delivery on extensive amounts of seismic data, at least on the North Slope. I'm not sure about the other parts of the state, but to your point, that information is helpful and will be publicly available. So appreciate it. Thanks.
Representative Johnson.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the presenter, I just wanted to say thank you for your presentation today. It's much appreciated. But I guess I'm still, you know, rolling a lot of this around in my head, and I was wondering, now, my understanding is under our current tax structure, we're actually bringing in more money to the state than we are or would be under ACES. I'd just like to hear you speak to that and, you know, any possibility of going back to that tax system.
Representative Justice Chair, I think from what little I've looked into it, and that's only looking at others' presentations that have said SB 21 brings in more now than ACES, that's looking in narrow isolation at only, let's say, the current year. I think if you go back, as we did to the drivers and the strategic goals of ACES, it was taxed heavily when there's windfall profits. And therefore, as a state, you will have the money in your coffers. So that way, if and when low prices come and your take is low, you're able to call upon that money that you saved away in order to continue to run your government. So if you took away taxing at the high end, you obviously don't have in your coffers the money to pay at the lower end. But ACES, you're correct in that ACES would have taken less now because it would have taken more during the good times.
Thank you very much.
Okay, just want to review a couple things. Last week, the education tax credit issue came up, so we resent that report out to all committee members to the extent that's helpful. We had a request, Mr. Ruggiero, on the slides that looked at the government take, if you had additional information for the years 2012 to 2016. You mentioned a 2007 report, if you wouldn't mind sending that along. And then Representative Rauscher had a question about the other government take slide that showed your hypothetical scenario that just showed the United States but didn't have Alaska split out on its own, if it's possible to produce a slide that shows just Alaska in relation to those other locations. And then we stopped taking questions at slide number 40, so if any member has a question on those slides, please get those to our office so we can get those to Mr. Ruggiero, and we'll get those answered and distributed as quickly as possible. Is there any other business to come before the committee? Okay, thank you so much. At 3:07, this meeting is adjourned.